This is Hometown Heroes. Honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, getting Arlanda Ritchie's story today. He served in the 87th Infantry Division in Europe in World War II. We've heard about how a patrol he had volunteered for was overrun by German forces, how he and his fellow soldiers split up, and how he survived all alone until help arrived from the French underground. The 16 weeks he spent missing in action had him hiding quite a bit. And we left off with this young soldier who had a wife and son back home, hiding under a bunch of blankets in the basement as four German soldiers came down the stairs.
And pretty soon, I left all quiet, and I thought, and I could hear them talking. I said, well, these guys are going to kill me if I don't do something. And it turned out to be that they were all untrained troops of officers, to say, protected people. And they had absolutely no training at all. They was carrying their swords and all their for novelties, you know. So I decided that's going to kill me. If they found me, they're sure going to kill me, even if they had any training or not. So I got out of that troop, and I got around the corner of that hut. One of them come around, I gave him a karate chop and put him out of action and kicked him in the head. And then I kept on. I got all four of them down, and I actually felt that I had murdered four people. I actually felt that. It bore on my conscience, still bears there, that I had murdered them four people. But, you know, that's what they're going to do to me. So.
I can't imagine how tense every single one of those days must have been to constantly live in fear of being discovered, of being captured, of, who knows, of, like you said, of being killed. Looking back on it now, what do you think it was that got you through that?
God. I prayed every time I got a chance. God, get me through this. And I believed he would.
I guess that's maybe something the rest of us could take a clue from. When you're constantly hiding somewhere, hoping no one sees you, not moving a muscle, gives you a lot of time to pray, huh?
It's real tough. You're afraid to move. You're afraid to do anything. You think maybe I was, Jesus, sometimes I wanted to cough, and I just control that, you know. Oh, man, it's hard.
This is probably a really hard question to answer. But over those 16 weeks, how many different people, French, German, or otherwise, do you think risked their lives to help save yours?
I've often thought about that. I really don't know, but they're very dedicated to what they were doing. They understood what the situation was with me, and I failed to understand exactly what they was going through then. But after I got back to the company and the war was over, I thought, man, I don't know how many people they lost in that, you know. The Germans was no dummy people. The only time you figure that you're smarter than the enemy, you get in trouble. You figure the enemy's smarter than you are, and you might get out of that thing alive, but you figure that you're smarter than they are, you don't do that, because they're smart people. They're very good people. They just got led by the wrong man.
You mentioned that one escape that you had to make with the four Germans that were looking for you down there. Were there any other moments like that in that 16 weeks where you came really close to being caught?
No, that's the closest. But several times we moved out just ahead of them because they'd tell me they're coming right behind us, you know, they're a mile or two back there. They did constantly searching for prisoners, you know. Like I say, I trusted in God. God helped me out here.
So what did it feel like when you finally saw American uniforms again and got to speak Okie English to some guys from back home in the good old USA?
Oh, God, I can't explain how thrilled I was to be back home and be back. I actually felt like I was back home with my own people, you know. It's just a great feeling. The old mess sergeant there, we went into the camp. He had a big pot of coffee, and Lord mercy, I was a coffee drinker. You know? He said, just sit down there and have all the coffee you want.
I imagine, too, they wanted to know what you'd been through. They probably had a little debriefing session with you, right?
Yeah, they had a session with me. I told them as much as I could to attend. I was very thin. I'd been lost a lot of weight. My nerves was on edge. I couldn't hardly get around, you know. It bothered me.
And this was pretty close to the end of the war by then?
Yeah, it was getting pretty close. When they took me to Camp Garson rehab, I'd got back on my feet pretty good, and I could hobble around. And this figuring on a big raid on Tokyo. So the company commander there called me in the orderly room one day, and he said, we're going to send you on a 30-day furlough home. That's what we think you can make it. He says, at the end of that 30 days, then we're going to put you on orders to go to the South Pacific. Yeah, and I said, I've already been to war. He said, well, they're going to send you. You're needed over there. I said, why am I needed when there's 100,000 other people here that could go too that hadn't been on the front? He said, well, your MOS says you're needed over there. That MOS is military occupational specialty. And I was good at weapons and training people in weapons. So. But while I was home, they dropped that bomb on Hiroshima, I think it was.
Saved your life, huh?
Saved my life. I wouldn't be here talking to you if that bomb had went off.
And you mentioned realizing that your wife had sent all those letters after all. And I can't imagine what a revelation that was at the time. But I imagine it paled in comparison to actually seeing her again and seeing a son who had grown a little bit. What do you remember about that moment being reunited with your wife and son?
I felt like, you know, that she'd left me for somebody else, which I really couldn't blame her. I got back to the hospital there in Staten Island. They asked me, did I want to send a telegram to my wife? I said, I don't have a wife. Well, it says on your service record you got a wife. That's what my service record says. What I'm telling you, I don't have a wife. So they went ahead and got in the service record and got my home address and sent her a wire. And then she mailed one back to me, and I just didn't know what to do. You know, she didn't explain. And I'd wrote her every time I had a chance, I'd write her, you know. So finally, she got to come out, talk to her, and I felt so odd, you know. I felt like I was talking to someone strange, you know. I didn't know what it went on in between, you know. She says, I've been with no other man. I says, well, only you know that. Only you know that. I wanted to make it easier for her. Turned out she hadn't been. It put trust back into our marriage, and it's just one of those misfortune things that happened. I felt guilt, and I felt happy, and gosh, I just don't know. I can't explain exactly how I did feel it.
Well, and you mentioned where you were was the hospital. That tells me that you weren't in the best of shape. What kind of physical challenges were you facing?
Well, my feet was absolutely bad. My teeth was bad. They pulled the teeth, got false teeth, and they got my feet patched up pretty good, so as good as they could, you know. That was what I was back there for at Camp Carson. We had people all over that had frozen feet. A lot of them lost toes, lost feet, whole feet, you know. I was lucky I didn't lose no toes or nothing, but it still bothers me. That's why I was in the hospital there. I never went back to hospital for any wounds, bullet wounds or anything like that, but the shrapnel in my shoulders and arms didn't bother me a whole lot. I just, you know, he'd been scratched up pretty good, but they hadn't gone real deep. This arm here still has shrapnel in it.
Your right arm up by your shoulder?
Right in there. They got the most of it out, but that one piece is in there so close to a nerve that they're afraid to bother it. If they just touch that nerve hardly, I'd lose my right arm, you know, lose the use of my right arm. But they said, just leave it go if you don't want to take a chance of losing your arm. I said, I'd rather have that there than to lose the chance of me losing my right arm. I still got it in there, but...
You know, it's very clear from everything that you've shared with us. And we talk about veterans and their service and their sacrifice. And I think the sacrifice part of that has been made very clear through this interview. The sacrifices that you made over there, the things that you went through physically and emotionally, mentally. Was it all worth it? Was what you did over there worth the price that you've paid for these last 70 years?
Yeah, I'd do it again.
Why?
I don't know. Just... patriotic to my country. I believe in my country, and I believe in my flag. I believe in freedom, and I saw how people was handicapped over there by a ruler of one man, you know, a fanatic man, and what their fears was of him. And I thought, well, we don't have that at home. And it's what I'm doing here now is worth what I had to do, you know. And I guess if I was called on again, well, I'd probably do the same thing. But one thing, when you're in the combat, though, patriotism goes out the window. You fight to save yourself. To save yourself. That's your main priority.
Well, it's a good thing you were able to save yourself, or that you were able to be saved, because you had a couple more kids that wouldn't have been born. You got some grandkids and great-grandkids that wouldn't be here either. And I wouldn't have had the pleasure of this interview with you today, so I'm thankful for that. And I want to ask you also about Honor Flight, because you are signed up to go to Washington, D.C. with other World War II veterans to see the World War II Memorial, a memorial that recognizes what you did and pays special honor to the 400,000 Americans who didn't get to come home from World War II. Why do you want to go? What do you hope it means to you?
Well, I want to see my name put on that memorial nationally. That's the first priority. And the next thing I'd like to have time to go over that memorial a little bit and see names of people that might be lost. That were my good friends, and if they did get lost, if they was killed in action, I don't know what the memorial will tell me except names. I don't know if it'll explain anything other than that, but I want to go see.
Yeah, you know, if you aren't familiar with the World War II Memorial, in addition to the sections for different theaters of the war and the names of every state, of course, that centerpiece fountain with the wall of gold stars marking the price of freedom, on the perimeter of the memorial is a kiosk where you can pull up a digital registry of World War II veterans. In fact, if you want, you can access that online right where you are and even submit the name and information of the veteran in your life. Speaking of names, Mr. Ritchie, you also interacted with two of the most famous names in terms of American generals in World War II. That even includes a future U.S. president. What's the story there?
Eisenhower was a major at Fort Lewis, had the 1st Battalion of the 15th Infantry when I went in. He was a very good commander. He was a very tough commander. He always wore white gloves, and on Saturday morning, if he run his finger down your chamber of your rifle and it comes out a little bit soiled, you stayed home that weekend. You didn't go to town. So you took special interest in that particular spot of your rifle. He was a major then, and then he left there and went to War College, and the next thing I heard from him is in North Africa. Yeah, I've met him, and Patton came around one morning there. It was really cold that night, kind of a dry cold, but yet there was moisture in the air in the foxhole, you know. And your machine gun, if you didn't work it once in a while, why, it would freeze up, you know. So he had to keep working that about every 5 minutes, you know, or to keep it loosened up. He used to come by and was working that machine gun. He says, "You better oil that son of a that you're going to need it in a little while." Every other word was him, was a cuss word, you know. Looked up and he's sitting up there in dry clothes, you know, the war boots on and a big fur collar. And I thought, "Oh, why don't you go back where you came from?" But he was a frontline soldier. He always says he kept himself comfortable, though, which is normal. You know, he's a commander.
You didn't ask him for his pearl pistol, huh?
No. I didn't really look to see if he had them on or not. I was kind of aggravated at him. I looked up and saw him up there in a nice fur coat, you know, and I'm down there freezing. My feet froze. I'm cold all over, and he's up there in the fur clothes, and I just thought, "Well, who the hell are you?" You know.
Well, that goes, they called them old blood and guts, and sounds like you were among the camp that said, "Our blood, his guts."
Yeah, our blood and his guts. He was a good commander, though. He is a feared commander.
History certainly reflects that. You've been very open about how you felt about things with your wife early on and all that. Now you've been married 71 years. You must be doing something right. What do you think's the secret to your long-lasting marriage?
Communication is the main thing. You got communication with your spouse, why most everything else will fall in place. Oh, we have tough times, too. I mean, we have arguments and things that don't go right sometimes, but that's normal. This is normal as life. But the main thing is communication. If you lose that, well, you lose a lot in your marriage. She's always been honest with me, and I've tried to be honest with her.
It sounds simple.
It sounds simple. It's not easy to do, though. And there's got to be love involved, too. You got to love her. She's got to love you.
Well, I guess in closing, I should ask you, what are you most proud of, and what are you most thankful for?
Well, what I'm most proud of is my family. And we've had a lot of longevity in our marriage, which I'm thankful for, too. And sometimes it gets a little rocky on the first 25 years, it gets real rocky, you know.
I'm only halfway to 25. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, really, communication is the main ingredient that I think is important.
Well, I'm going to keep working on that, and I'm so glad that you communicated with us so candidly today. Thank you for serving our country. Thank you for having the courage to share your story. And I hope that trip with Honor Flight in October is the experience of a lifetime for you. That is Arlanda Ritchie. You'll find some great photos of him on Facebook. Just pull up Hometown Heroes Radio. And, of course, tune in again next time when I take you out to California's Central Coast in a conversation with a combat engineer who spent a lot of his time clearing minefields. That's not a dangerous job or anything, right? If you're free next weekend and you want to see some great examples of World War II aircraft, head to Atwater and Castle Air Museum for Open Cockpit Day, Sunday, September 1st. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.